Good morning, people. This is DJ Scrappy, and you're listening to Worldwise here at radio.dominican.edu. I'd like to welcome you to our show. This is Worldwise. I'm DJ Scrappy. This is our first broadcast ever. I'm excited. I hope you are too. Worldwise is a show about science, nature, the environment, all things people care about. You were just listening to Jimmy Cliff, Sitting in Limbo. So let's move on with our show. First up for you, I got The Strange Case of the Missing Dwarf. So the European Space Observatory is a satellite that's orbiting Earth, and they just got a new instrument called the Sphere Instrument. And it was supposed to show a brown dwarf that's orbiting a star system that has a weird orbit. So some pairs of stars consist of two normal stars with slightly different masses. When the star of a slightly higher mass ages and expands to become a red giant, material is transferred to other star and ends up surrounding both stars in a huge gaseous envelope. And when this cloud disperses, the two move closer together and form a very tight pair with one white dwarf and one more normal star. One such stellar pair is called V471 Tauri, and this is the one we're talking about. It is a member of the Hyades star cluster in the constellation of Taurus, and is estimated to be around 600 million years old and about 163 light years from Earth. So it's pretty close on our galactic scale. The two stars are very close and orbit each other about every 12 hours. And these are, well, a red giant is a supermassive star. And so this orbit is pretty high and erratic. Twice per orbit, one star passes in front of the other, so you get kind of like an eclipse effect, which leads to regular changes in the brightness of the pair observed here on Earth. A team over there of astronomers led by Adam Hardy, he's from the University of Valparaiso in Chile, they first used the UltraCram system on the ESO's New Technology Telescope to measure these brightness changes very precisely. The times of the eclipses were measured with an accuracy of better than 2 seconds. So there was a really big hunch that this brown dwarf that they were suspecting was there was going to be there. And it was a big improvement on earlier measures, too. So, oh, you know what? Let me just turn up my microphone here. Here we go. Hope you can hear me better. So up to now, however, it's been impossible to actually image a faint brown dwarf so close to such bright star cluster as Tauri is. But the power of the newly installed Sphere instrument on the ESO's Very Large Telescope allowed the team to look for the first time exactly where the brown dwarf companion was. But they saw nothing, and you know, this is high-tech new instrument. Even though the quality of the images from the Sphere, you know, it should have easily revealed it. There are many papers suggesting that the existence of such binary objects, such as these stars, but the results here provide damaging evidence about this hypothesis. And that's coming from Adam Harley, the lead astronomer on the team. So anyways, yeah, if there's no orbiting object, then what is causing the odd change of the orbit of this binary, you know? Several theories have been proposed, and while some of these have hardly been ruled out, it's possible that the effects are caused by magnetic field variations in the larger of the two stars. So just the makeup of these stars could be causing its strange orbit. And it's somewhat similar to the changes we've been seeing in the sun in terms of solar flares. Another quote from Adam Hardley is, a study as such has been necessary for years, but has only become possible with the advent of a powerful new instrument such as the Sphere technology. This is, however, science at work, and observations with new technology can either confirm or, as in this case, disprove earlier ideas. So, womp womp. It's an excellent way to start the observational life of this amazing instrument. So, you know, hopefully, in the lifetime of the Sphere instrument, we'll get better surprises. turning heads here, I'm going to switch gears, and we're going to talk about Malaysian dolphins. They've been used for fishing in Malaysian's culture for a long time. And now they're in danger of electrofishing. So this is coming from National Geographic. So the Myanmar River dolphin is the type of porpoise that we're speaking of particularly. And on the Irrawaddy River, I don't know if I said that right, Irrawaddy River in Myanmar or Burma, you can find these river dolphins. And it's pretty easy to get them to cooperate to fish on the river. So what they're doing is they're kind of acting like fish, like sheepdogs. Yeah, that's the right euphemism. Sheepdogs and how they corral sheep. So the dolphin works in the same way, rather, in corralling fish. So what these people are starting to do is they're using a new thing that's called electrofishing. It's new and it's illegal, but the technique in which the fishermen are using, it stuns the fish and it makes it easier for them to scoop it up in bunches. The tactic is depleting the fish stocks that feed the already endangered Irrawaddy dolphins. So it is an endangered species. And it is thought that inadvertently killed two dolphins. So it might actually be electrocuting the fish, well, the dolphins, rather, instead of just stunning them like they are with the other fish. So the Irrawaddy River is the longest river in Burma, and it holds a lot of their major towns, too. It is a source of a lot of other rivers, lakes, and seas. And it's just northwest of the Bay of Bengal in India. You know, I'm going to switch tracks again because I'm having a hard time with that one. You know what? I'm going to take us on a little commercial break. And I will be right back. This is DJ Scrappy here on Worldwise. You're listening to radio.dominican.edu. But when I tried to speak out, felt like no one could hear me. Wanted to belong here, but something felt so wrong here. So I prayed I could break up. Touch the sky now. Make a wish, take a chance, make a change, and break away. Out of the darkness and into the sun. But I won't forget all the ones that I love. I'll take a risk, take a chance, make a change, and break. The sky, and I'll make a wish, take a chance, make a right, guys, this is DJ Scrappy, and we're back with Worldwise. Sorry about that. I was having a little bit of technical difficulties here on the first show. You're listening to Worldwise. So we were talking about the Malaysian river dolphin before that. I just want to switch topics real quick. There is new evidence of climate change in China 4,200 years ago. It was a drastic climate change event in northern China, and it affected vegetation and led to mass migration from the area. And this study just came out 3 days ago. Using a relatively new scientific dating technique, a Baylor University geologist and team of international researchers were able to document, for the first time, a drastic climate change 4,200 years ago in northern China that affected vegetation and led to mass migration from the area. Steve Foreman, PhD professor of geology in the College of Arts and Sciences, and researchers using a dating technique called optically simulated luminescence, uncovered the first evidence of a severe decrease in precipitation over the freshwater lake system in China's Hushandaki sandy lakes, or sandy lands, rather. The impact of this extreme climate change led to desertification, or the drying out of the region, and the mass migration of northern China's Neolithic cultures. The research findings appear in the January 2015 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and are available online as well. Foreman says, with our unique scientific capabilities, we are able to assert with confidence.
Come with me, we're heaven bound. The time has come.
Okay, sorry about that. Yes, between 2001 and 2014, the researchers investigated sediment sections throughout the Hushandaki and were able to determine that a sudden and irreversible shift in the monsoon system led to the abrupt and drying of the Hushandaki, resulting in complications for the population. This disruption of the water flow significantly impacted human activities in the region and limited water availability. The consequences of a rapid climate shift of the Hushandaki hurting agricultural cultures were likely catastrophic. He said that these climate changes and drying of the Hushandaki continued to adversely impact the current population today. The Hushandaki remains arid, and even with drying off, the rehabilitation efforts will unlikely regrow dense vegetation. This study has far-reaching implications for understanding how populations respond and adapt to drastic climate change. Foreman is the director of the Geoluminescence Data Researching Lab in the Department of Geology. The study co-authors include Zhao Pingyang, PhD of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and Louis A. Scuderi, PhD of the University of New Mexico. The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences reports that the significance of this paper as follows. In contrast to earlier assertions, the deserts in northern China are 106 years old. Our multidisciplinary investigation in the Hushandaki sandy lands located in the eastern portion of China's desert belt shows that this is circa 4,000 years old. This study documents dramatic environmental and landscape changes in this desert during the last 10,000 years. For the first time, to our knowledge, we present a case of desertification mainly triggered by changes in the hydrological and geomorphical system associated with climate change at around 4,200 years ago. Our research to the human-environment interactions in the Hushandaki suggests Chinese civilization may be rooted in the migrant areas in the north rather than in the middle reaches of the Yellow River. And in the middle of the late Holocene, Earth's monsoonal regions experienced catastrophic precipitation decreases that produced green to desert state shifts. Resulting hydroelectric regime change negatively impacted water availability and Neolithic cultures. Whereas mid-Holocene drying is commonly attributed to slow insolation reduction and subsequent nonlinear vegetation atmosphere feedbacks that produce threshold conditions. Moving on, We have a report here about stoplights, or rather being stopped at a stoplight, and how they are hotspots for airborne pollution. In this study, it's, in fact, you're 20 times more likely to get harmful particles than if you were driving along the open road. So being stuck at a red light isn't just frustrating, it's a bad for your health. Drivers are exposed to more harmful pollutants when idling at intersections than when zooming along in an open road. Scientists reported on February 12th in Atmospheric Environment. When cars and trucks burn fuel, they emit tiny pollutants that have been linked to heart and respiratory illness. To see whether intersections are hotspots for these nonparticles, researchers drove in a 6-kilometer-long loop through Guildford, England, and measured how their concentration of pollution changed along the route. Though the drivers only spent roughly 2% of their time at stoplights, the time accounted for about 25% of their total exposure to pollutants. At intersections, the concentration of nanoparticles was up to 20 times high as it was on uncongested stretches. You emit a lot of particles when you are at a traffic light, says the co-author Prashant Kumar, a civil environmental engineer at the University of Surrey in England. So do all the cars idling right next to you. And accelerating that moment you rev the engine when the light turns green? Well, that releases more emissions than driving at a steady pace. The good news is that drivers have at least a little control over how much pollution they inhale. If you're at a traffic light, it's best to keep the windows up. I mean, that should be common knowledge. But also keep the fan off. Drivers should also try to stay and keep their distance from the cars in front of them. So if you just use a little bit more spacing at a stop sign, you should be all right. So now on to mental science. There's new research that says you can't punish a psychopath the same way as you can everyone else, according to science. So the word psychopath, it evokes a terrifying heart thump in some, probably all, but someone murderous, remorseless, emotional, unstoppable, like a Hannibal Lecter type or Anton Chigurh. Emerging recent research, however, has painted a gradually more nuanced portrait of psychopathy. Not all psychopaths are thoroughly unrepentant killers, which is astounding. And not all psychopaths have every single characteristic of psychopathy. Some researchers maintain that psychopathy is best seen as a spectrum disorder, kind of like autism. Psychopaths are more or less callous, unempathetic, glib, grandiose, manipulative, dishonest, promiscuous. A lot of negative connotations, and they're unable to recognize negative emotions in other people. They also tend to be impulsive, contrary to what you see in the movies, which means punishment is strikingly ineffective in deterring them from undesirable behavior. A new study in Lancet Psychiatry shows that psychopaths are not, however, actually impervious to any sort of punishment. Rather, that psychopaths process rewards and punishments differently from most people. As a result of their processing of rewards and punishments, their decision-making skills are a little atypical. Previous studies have shown a difference in brain structure, but now we can see a difference in brain function, and that's from Sheila Hodgkins, professor of psychiatry at the University of Montreal, and one of the study's authors. The researchers looked at MRIs of psychopaths adjusting their behavior as the consequences for a task switched from a simple task to a more repetitive one. But the consequences went from positive to negative, and it was deliberately made to task them with simple push-the-button tasks. And even those very simple ones had very dramatic differences from someone who does not register as a psychopath. When these violent offenders completed a neuropsychological task, they failed to learn from punishment cues. They didn't change their behavior in the face of contingencies and made poor quality decisions despite longer periods of deliberation. Yes, so previous studies had actually shown that psychopaths have more trouble than typical people at switching behaviors when consequences shift from positive to negative. Most of us are able to adjust from behavior pretty quickly when an action that has previously been rewarding suddenly becomes punishing. Psychopaths, on the other hand, persist. And they persist at a given behavior, even though it may become punishing. The MRI in the Lancet study indicates that this was not because psychopaths don't feel punishment or aren't aware of punishment. In fact, the psychopaths actually showed increased activity in certain parts of the brain, specifically in the posterior cingulate cortex and the anterior insula. When they received unexpected punishment, rather than processing it normally, they processed it differently. They also showed anomalous brain activity for unexpected rewards, so different areas of the brain were lighting up as opposed to normal. Given that psychopaths process rewards and punishments differently, it's not surprising that they tend to be different or riskier decision makers. Some people think that decision making or proper decision making is personified by, of all people, Spock from Star Trek. As everyone knows this character, it's kind of like reasoning without the absence or presence of emotion. Yet practical reasoning and emotion are pretty much linked according to this study. Suppose you get $2,000 this year on your tax refund. You might go out and, I don't know, buy a $2,000 bottle of Remy Martin. Or you might fix up your roof or, I don't know, buy a new dishwasher. The thing is, people who weigh rewards and punishments differently will make different decisions about which of these options provides to them the greater pleasure or poison. Decision-making and learning both require emotions. We decide what to do based on unexpected rewards and punishments, and we learn through emotional reinforcement, wrote Jesse Prinz, distinguished professor of philosophy at CUNY, who specializes in cognitive science. If psychopaths have unusual patterns or emotional responsiveness, then they are likely to make decisions and learn somewhat different than other people. Psychopaths show over-optimism. They always think behaviors will be rewarded, and they don't pay attention to punishment. Predicting punishment tells you behavior is inappropriate, explains Hodgins. Now, after this study, she added, we can see that what we observed behaviorally has a neural reason. Prinz, another associate, says, when interviewed, criminal psychopaths sometimes sound indignant about their incarceration. Sometimes they're startled, they're surprised to be caught, and they think that punishment is undeserved. What seems to be what's going on here, they think. They think that they have the right to rule, and then suddenly there's a punishment. And telling them that, hey, you're wrong, sparks off something in their brain. For non-psychopaths, that's no big surprise. They are told in advance that, hey, there's a rule, and if you break it, the rules change. Psychopaths are more surprised or perhaps even indignant. You know, how could I be wrong? How dare they change the rule? Activations in the posterior cingulate and insula are consistent with these negative emotions. However, Prinz also states that at least a little on recent psychopathy research, he expressed some reservations about attributing too much importance to either symptom checklists or structural and functional differences in the brain of psychopaths. Psychopathy may not even be a cohesive disorder. It's really a diverse hodgepodge of symptoms. And people with very different profiles can end up with the same diagnosis, states Prinz. And people with very different, there is always a danger of making it look as if criminality is biologically determined, as in phrenology from the last century. But neuroimaging studies increase that impression by making it sound like this is a cohesive category and implying that it is biologically based. But differences in brains takes by averaging across individuals imply neither of these findings. The Lancet study determined whether its subjects were psychopaths by using a widely accepted checklist of symptoms, the PCLR. Even using the checklist strictly, two people with the same presentations might have different diagnoses. So the researchers relied on a previous study that determined that in the North America, you need a score of 30 out of 40 to be considered a psychopath, whereas in Europe, you only need to get a 25 to be a psychopath. The suggested explanation by the authors is that since North Americans in general are more glib, grandiose, and promiscuous than Europeans, that North American psychopath will be more glib, grandiose, and promiscuous than European psychopathic counterpart. Taken together, the recent research on psychopathy might suggest that there is some way in which psychopaths are not merely unwilling to make decisions just as others do, but are unable to. If a psychopath is unable to make moral decisions, some say any punishment not only ineffective, but also undeserved. So, one interesting article in the Telegraph on psychopathy cites neuroscientist Dave Eagleman's belief that instead of thinking in terms of blameworthiness, the law should deal with the likelihood that someone will reoffend and issue sentences accordingly. With rehabilitation for those likely to be benefited and long sentences for those likely to be long-term dangers. Matthew Talbert, associate professor of philosophy at West Virginia University, who studies moral responsibility, disagrees, though. He argues that even though there is a way in which psychopaths don't fully understand or at least feel the pull of moral reasoning the way typical people do, psychopaths can nonetheless be morally blameworthy. He says what's important here is that a psychopath acts for bad reasons. He acts with contempt for other people. Typically, if he hurts someone, it's a choice, not a compulsive act. If a cop had been standing there, he wouldn't have done that, states Matthew. Talbert also told the Beast, if you believe that all our mental states originate in our brains, any wrongdoing is always explicable in terms of brain process or structure. The psychopath himself is highly unlikely to decide he is blameworthy. Psychopaths generally don't have an interest in being treated or cured. Their lives are not, in their opinion, deprived. They don't have remorse over their lack of remorse. This is chilling to consider in the case of the violent offenders as well as the nonviolent aggressors such as con artists or swindlers. But there are also psychopaths who are nonviolent and who hold jobs in the community. Do they need to be treated? Is it easy to look at their lives and see them as emotionally shallow, lacking in everything? Gives most people their shape and purpose. Love, relationships, moral development. These are normal things. However, presumably, they look at others' lives and see them as unbearable and wasteful and encumbered by guilt, shame, pity, or fear. Is psychopathy an impairment? Well, that's hard to say, says Prince. Psychopathic traits are widespread in the population, and many who score positively on diagnostic criteria lead productive and successful lives. Coming back to overconfidence, those who believe in themselves often have an advantage in the world. Sometimes poor judgment does pay off. This recalls what William James, the philosopher and psychologist, once said about how you need to believe you are liked before anyone actually likes you. Otherwise, no one will actually like you. Do you like me or not? For example, whether you do or not depends, in countless instances, on whether I meet you halfway and willing to assume that you must like me and show trust and expectation. The previous faith on my part in your liking existence is in such cases what makes your liking come. But if I stand aloof and refuse to budge an inch until I have objective evidence, until you shall have done something, you know, appropriate, as the absolutists would say, ad extra quendam ascensum mem ten. 10 to 1, you likely never come. So basically, if you're willing to meet me halfway, then chances are we're going to get along. Hodgins hopes her group's study will be the beginning of work that might lead to effective interventions in children who exhibit conduct disorders that might eventually develop into psychopathy. Interventions must occur in childhood since adults are so resistant to treatment. A better understanding of the distinctive flavor of the psychopath's processing of punishment would certainly give us a better way to handle such children. parent training programs can be very effective with other conduct disorders, but are far less effective with those who eventually become psychopaths. We want effective interventions for young children with conduct problems who receive rejection from peers, parents, teachers, to stop that those conduct problems from escalating, Hodgins says. Violent crimes by psychopaths, she hopes, could one day be averted before punishment needs to be considered. So, going from psychopaths, I have a new segment on a new study about hot guys and if they are a-holes. We'll be right back. This is Worldwise. You're listening to DJ Scrappy.
Lost on my knees, on knees.
right, welcome back to Penguin Radio. This is DJ Scrappy D. You're listening to Worldwise, where we explore science and environmental issues here on radio.dominican.edu. We were just talking about psychopaths, and we're going to continue now with a little bit more about how science says hot guys are a-holes. A new study puts some science behind the claim, and that attractive men are, well, not the friendliest. New research has discovered that attractive men are more selfish than their less aesthetically gifted peers, putting a firm end to our dreams of finding an altruistic Adonis. Psychologists at Brunel University in London measured the bodies of 125 men and women using a 3D scanner and calculating traditionally attractive traits such as slimness and waist-to-hip ratio, for the latter group. They then completed a personality test, which assessed their attitudes to selfishness and inequality, before partaking in a money-based economics experiment designed to challenge their beliefs on having or sharing. Dr. Michael Price says our results showed that, in fact, we may be justified in expecting more attractive men to behave in ways that are less favorable in economic and social equality. The results suggest that better-looking men may be biased towards being more selfish and less egalitarian. The research team also gathered a group of raters to judge the attractiveness of the participants. A second group was asked to determine how egalitarian they thought the test subjects would be in real life, with the raters deemed the best-looking of the bunch to be the least equality-minded. Shocking. While these assessments were valid for the men in the study, perhaps unprecedented development was among the women involved, who were found to be no more selfish than average lookers. This proves that hotties aren't hardwired to be douchier than naughties. just that good-looking men are seemingly incapable of caring about anyone other than themselves. And, well, we love attractiveness, reasons the dating blogger Kitty Salt. In fact, the hotter, the more likely it is that they burn out our retinas and make us blind to our obvious shortcomings. But we must remind ourselves that having a certain visual allure creates a veil. We are guilty of overlooking someone's flaws in favor of their strengths. But if flaws are personality-based, then they usually don't change. Attractiveness, being perceived as a strength, dates back to early human ancestral environments, where physically admirable or formidable people were deemed to have a greater ability to benefit or harm others, thus increasing their bargaining power in social situations. These naturally bestowed traits, such as fitness and developmental stability, would have given them a certain predisposition to win social competitions, thereby benefiting from any advanced status or resources that followed. So it looks like it's pretty biologically hardwired. This unequal balance would swing in favor of society's lookers, meaning that they would value social norms promoting inequality as it would serve them best, while average guys would find that those promoting equality the most advantageous. While strength, and therefore inequality, among men was more valuable in early civilizations than it was for women, this doesn't really explain why they are still less inclined to support equality than the opposite sex. I don't think there is enough basis for speculation, says Dr. Price, but he adds, people who are more attractive have to do less to make themselves valuable to other people, because they're already highly valuable by virtue of their high attractiveness. This isn't the end of the road for self-serving sexpots, though. The best way to help people overcome a bias is to make them more conscious that they have it. And plus, you know, being selfish isn't necessarily the biggest deal-breaker in the world, although the whole perpetuating social inequality for personal gain thing, it's a touch disconcerting. With scientific proof of their narcissism in a recent study of how wide-faced men are more self-interested, at least we have all the necessary tools for avoiding these sexy broadsheet egotists, should we choose, which works for me. There's more to look at than we see, and things are always nice for a while at least. And if you're looking for the world's next social freedom fighter, though, you might want to look outside the gym. This is DJ Scrappy D. You're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. We are moving to our next story, which is ocean animals and how they have bulked up since prehistory or ancient times. Marine animals have become much bigger. Scientists reports in February in the issue of Science. This finding lends evidence to Cope's rule, which states that animals often evolve to be larger than their distant ancestors. The hypothesis takes its name from the 19th century paleontologist Edward Drinker Cope, who noticed this trend in the fossil record. Which I guess is pretty accurate. I mean, we are bigger than our ancestors. The researchers compared body size measurements of animals over a period spanning from 542 million years ago during the Cambrian period to today. And the animals included species from more than 17,000 genera, among them trilobites, plesiosaurs, whales, and clams, as well as many lesser creatures, but still nonetheless familiar. Marine animals today are on average 150 times larger than they were during the Cambrian, the researchers found. The smallest animals alive today, tiny crustaceans called ostracods, are only about one-tenth the size of the Cambrian tiniest animals. But today's largest marine animals, whales, are more than 100,000 times bigger than the biggest in the Cambrian. So, in the Cambrian period, it was mostly just trilobites and crustaceans. So, I wouldn't imagine that there would be anything that ginormous as a whale that we have today. The classes of animals that were already big tended to persist longer and diversify more than the classes that were on average smaller, says Noel Heim, a co-author of the study and a paleontologist at Stanford University. The size gains in marine animals are much larger than would be expected by chance, says Jonathan Payne, another co-author at Stanford. The scientists don't know for sure what drives the trend. One possibility is an arms race between predators and prey, which could highly be likely. The bigger you are, the less likely you are to be attacked. And in this case, in which larger animals are less likely to become, you know, a snack. Another is that when mammals and reptiles return to the ocean, retain the ability to breathe oxygen-rich air rather than water made it easier for them to outgrow many water-breathing animals, which also could be true. Moving on, our next story also involves life underseas. Hidden away in underwater caves for centuries, scientists make an unusual and extraordinary discovery. Down below, tucked away inside a series of underwater caves for thousands of years, there's been a graveyard littered with skeletons of extinct animals. And this is coming from National Geographic. The divers there found, anthropologists and paleontologists themselves, found hundreds of bones resting at the bed of the Avon Cave in, bear with me, Semanampatoutsa National Park in Madagascar. I'll try to say that again. Semanampatoutsa? Okay, I'll stop. Anyways, the remains of the extinct elephant bird, turtles, crocodiles, and other exotic species were covered. And from that data, we have a real cross-section, says Brooklyn College anthropologist Alfred Rosenberger, who is working with the National Geographic. Tiny things and big things. And it's kind of a strange mystery how it all ended up in this one cave. However, the most exciting discovery was the collection of bones found belonging to giant lemurs that once roamed the Earth. According to the National Science Foundation, which funded the project, the finding is one of the most unique sites in the world and could be one of the largest ever made. Going extinct sometime between 2,000 and 500 years ago, the largest of the extinct primates were as large as gorillas. The preservation is really, really incredible, says Rosenberger, adding, it's unusual because paleontologists often encounter broken bones, and a lot of these bones were as fine as when they were placed there. Experts are still trying to crack the mystery of how it all ended up in Avon Cave. Rosenberger said that some of the lemurs appear to have been defleshed in place. So early hominids, maybe other animals, could be. The abundance of the Malagasy remains is extraordinary, a Rutgers University anthropologist Susan Catchell says. According to her, the discovery could help break open a totally new era of underwater paleontology, which I'm guessing is a relatively new field. moving forward, bear with me for 1 second. All right, so eco drones, environmentally centered drone research, can it aid and help to fight to save the environment? We'll see. Drones are getting a green makeover, and environmentalists and earth scientists put the unmanned vehicles to a variety of eco-friendly jobs these days, from studying wildlife and polar ice melting to monitoring water for harmful bacteria to reforesting areas that have been over-harvested. At Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, Chris Zappa is planning his next mission to monitor ice melt in the Arctic, where drones will flit to places that icebreakers and manned aircraft don't dare to venture. These are places you can't get to without normal oceanographic capability, so we use drones, says Zappa, and he's an associate researcher, and said his office is at Lamont. We're looking at the marginal ice zone where the ocean meets the edge of the ice, seeing how fast and how slow the melting is occurring. Equipped with infrared cameras, the drones collect data on temperature changes and meltwater coming off the ice, adding that in the future, drones might actually be able to drop off microbuoys that will measure the temperature and salinity of the water. Coming at the problem from a different angle, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is monitoring the base of the polar ice with an underwater drone. A similar drone has been used to observe the deep water habits of great white sharks, which scientists knew very little about until they found a way to follow the big fish around. By attaching an electronic tag to a shark, Woods Hole scientists were able to program their underwater drone to follow the shark around, sometimes getting pretty close. On a recent mission, the drone, dubbed Remus, came back with some stunning and completely unexpected data on how great whites hunt. The drone, which was equipped with 5 cameras, showed in some very frightening footage what happened to 2 young sharks decided that the unmanned vehicle might be a nice snack. So you can guess what happened. Chomp chomp. What the video shows is unprecedented, says Amy Kokoyiga, the operations leader of the principal investigator for Remus Shark Cam Project. It's documenting a deep water attack and the vertical speed when sharks make an attack. It shows everything from the perspective of the shark. It's pretty far out. We realized that in Cape Cod that when a shark saw a kayaker on a surface, it had an encounter that was no different from what happened with the Remus. The shark was confused. And so they say, hey, let's take an exploratory bite. As it turns out, neither of the sharks that attacked the drone was the one being followed. Those 2 major attacks where you just jump out of your seat are 2 different sharks. First a male, and then a 25 minutes later a female shark attacked this drone. And it was pretty terrifying, definitely surprising. Flying drones are also being used by groups trying to protect whales and other big mammals from being killed by hunters. Each year, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society sends out its drones to watch over pilot whales. If the whales get too close to the Faroe Islands, where locals have yearly hunts, small boats are sent out to chase the whales away. Once we locate the whales, we drive them back to sea, said Paul Watson, co-founder of Sea Shepherd. 2 years ago, from June to September, there were 1,300 whales killed. Last year, we chased away about 12 pods. And while we're patrolling, only 32 were killed. For the most part, drones have served as watchers, but in the future they may take a lot more active role. A company called Biocarbon Engineering has designed a drone to quickly and efficiently plant trees. The goal is to rebuild global forests that have been decimated by lumbering, mining, agriculture, urban expansion, and deforestation. Company scientists have developed a prototype drone that uses a tiny cannon to shoot pods containing germinated seeds as well as nutrients and fertilizers to support the tree as it begins to grow. Isn't that kind of neat? So, I mean, on one hand, you have a drone that can shoot something, but on the other hand, it's shooting seeds. So, hey, maybe it's going to work out. And these pods, they just break open when they hit the ground, and they spill the germinated seeds and nutrients. Thus far, the method has only been tested in the lab, but Lauren Fletcher, company CEO and co-founder, says that his team entered their prototype in this year's UAE Drones for Good competition, which awards $1 million to the winning drone. This year's contest includes entries from over 800 teams and from 57 nations. There were 19 semifinalists, which were winnowed down to about 5, and the tree planting drone made it all the way to the finals, but was in the end beaten by a crash resistant drone that could be used to search for search and rescue. Eventually, Fletcher says, two operators with our technology could plant at least 36,000 trees a day. That's 10 times better than planting rate you can see with the human hand. The current type of tree planter can plant around 1,500 trees a day at a cost of about $3 per tree. With 100 teams of two operators, we would be able to do 1 billion trees a year. So we're talking about a massive reforestation program. Fletcher doesn't see his new device putting traditional tree planters out of business, though. With both types of planting going on, it still won't be enough to catch up with the deforestation that's already taking place today. There was, of course, stiff competition, including an entry from an MIT group called the Waterfly, which fields a swarm of drones that tests for the presence of deadly cyanobacteria in the water. The Waterfly was one of the 20 semifinalists at the UAE drone competition. This cyanobacteria are common in water all over the world, and under certain conditions they reproduce explosively and produce high quantities of poisonous cyanotoxins. It's very important to monitor them and keep them under control, says Carlo Ratti, a professor and director of the Sensible City Lab at MIT. The swarm monitors water from high, and then when something is detected, individual drones fly down to analyze the water, while the others still fly at high altitude. So how the swarm works is it's just hovering over, and then it only sends down a few at a time. This makes the swarming system much more efficient, and I guess less likely to crash. Okay. So a little bit more about drones. Do you guys know about that really big statue of Jesus Christ that's in Brazil? It's called Christ the Redeemer, and I believe it's in Rio de Janeiro. But it's Brazil's most iconic statue, and it's been completely scanned with a 3D dimension in 3D dimensions by a drone. Last fall, Next Lab of PUC University in Rio de Janeiro and a software company called Pix4D teamed up to create an exact virtual replica of the monument, which reaches nearly 125 feet into the air. They ended up using a quadricopter from a Canadian drone maker, Arion Labs. When visitors were gone, the team buzzed around the statue 19 times in 6 days and collected 3,584 images during its 10-minute flights, according to Arion. The statue had never been completely scanned, and the company said because the statue's size and location atop Corcovado Mountain make it hard to use methods like LiDAR. Now anyone with a 3D printer can create their own Christ the Redeemer in their own homes. So pretty neat from what we have happening with drones these days. So that's all I have for you today. This is DJ Scrappy D. You've been listening to Worldwise on radio.dominican.edu. I hope you have a pleasant rest of your Friday. Tune in next Friday, 11 to 12, to hear Worldwise with me, Scrappy D.